Hello and welcome to Inside the Press Box, the podcast where we dive into the captivating world of sporting journalism. I'm Josh Walters.
I'm Ollie Gray.
And I'm Jack O'Neill. Each week we'll bring you insider perspectives for the most engaged journalists within the UK.
So if you're ready to go beyond the scorelines and explore the fascinating world of sport journalism,
join us in the exciting journey and get ready to stop Inside the Press Box.
Welcome to Inside the Press Box podcast. I'm the host, Ollie Gray, for this episode. Today is special guest, Martin Smith. How are you doing, Martin?
I'm all right, lads. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Right, let's get started then. How did you get started in the industry?
It was a roundabout journey for me, and it's a bit of a long story, so I'll make it as brief as I can. I left school at 16 with no qualifications because I asked about for 4 or 5 years at school. It was more fun to mess around than it was to do any work, obviously. I had a interview at the local colliery and got a job there. But in the meantime, I'd been for an interview at Rolls-Royce factory in Hucknall, Nottinghamshire. So I took that job and did a 4-year apprenticeship there as a sheet metal worker. I stayed there until I was 23. Then I got out and went to work in a hotel in Devon, kind of a runaway thing for a summer. Came back, did a bit more sheet metal work, and then went to America for 4 months and came back and went back to America again for another 3 months. Then came back, did a tour around Europe in a Volkswagen with four other people, which was a bit tight, but good fun. Then I thought, I came to my sense, I got to sort myself out. So I started to do what you call GCSEs now. They were called O-levels at the time. I did three of those. Then I did A-levels similarly, part-time, while I was working in various factories doing sheet metal work mostly. But I had a job as a grill chef and a taxi driver and all sorts of jobs. Then I did that, and then I went to university, to Trent Polytechnic, as it was called then, in Nottingham. And you got a grant in those days. By this time, I was married with a baby, so we needed a grant, and I worked part-time as well. I did that, then passed that, and then I thought I better, by now I was 29 years old, but I better do something to make me stand out a bit. So I did an MA at Nottingham University in a subject called critical theory, which is all about critiquing language and literature, that kind of stuff. Then I got a job at the Worksop Guardian, a newspaper, North Notts. My newspapers were still relatively flourishing. After a couple of years there, I got a job at an agency in Sheffield, which did news and sport for national papers, BBC and ITV, and radio stations, doing sport and news for them. That was a great, about 18 months there. Then I got a job at the Sheffield Star as a sub-editor, and then I got moved from sub-editing to reporting. After a while, I was chief reporter there. Then I became sports editor. I had 7 years there. Did a freelance, free-ranging role, doing lots of feature writing all around the place. Went to a World Cup, went on various trips around the place. Then I became features editor, and then I left and came to Hallam. So there you go.
That's quite a story.
I made it as short as possible.
Well, yeah. Well, was anyone in your family or did you have any influences that were writing or had like a passion for writing or even like the arts or stuff like that? Or did you just...
Not really, no. The scene say the arts. Well, my parents were kind of kids in the war years, right. Second War years. So their education was really just basic because there was more things to worry about. So my mum and dad were quite bright, but my dad was a sheet metal worker as well. My mum worked in various jobs as a telephonist and in shops and stuff and a kind of office type jobs. My dad was into drumming. He was a drummer in the Boys Brigade when he was younger. He ought to have carried that on because he was pretty good. He was always very quick-witted and funny, my dad. So he got a bit of that going on as well. He'd made a good sub-editor, I used to tell him. He's gone now. And my mum was quite arty, painting and stuff, but kind of it was never really part of what you did for a job towards kind of thing. It wasn't that. Didn't really seem like you could do it for a job. I had to find that out later.
So it wasn't something that you thought you grew up with or grew up around or had naturally. Did you just sort of work on it quite a lot during, do you say when you were 29?
That's when I came out of university, Trent Poly, yeah. Well, I tell you, looking back, I should have known. Well, I did know, but it just was not really something that I considered I could do. I know a lot of people have this. When I was, what old would it have been? 13? Where are you all from? You're from the Sheffield area?
I am, yeah.
Okay, there's a football club in Nottinghamshire called Priory Celtic. And now it's got like 20 teams, boys and girls teams. It's based in Eastwood. No, I think it's moved now. It used to be based in Eastwood in Nottinghamshire. That football club started when we were 13 years old. My group of mates played the first game they ever played. Now it's a massive club, quite a big deal now. They had a dinner, 25-year, 40-year dinner, whatever it was. And I found a match report I wrote from the very first game on the game I played in. And they reproduced it in this program for the 40th anniversary or whatever it was. It never occurred to me that I could do that for a living. I was football mad like most kids. And I did a match report and drew, you know, did the teams out in formation. Looking back, it was fairly obvious that that's what I should have done. But it never really occurred to me that I could do that for a job, because it's nobody in my family had done anything like that. And I didn't know anybody else who had either.
So do you think, with obviously not knowing if you can go into it as a career, did you get any stick from any, like, say, family members or friends being like, oh, are you sure you want to do this type of thing? Because I guess if they didn't know as well.
Not so much stick as a bit unsure, you know, why do you want to do that? So I just wanted to, and at that time I wasn't convinced. When I started going back to college and stuff, I wasn't actually convinced that that's what I wanted to do. But it was sort of one of the things. But it seemed a long way off. But I just kept going down to go at it. And as I say, if I'd thought about it when I was 13, thinking, what do you want to do? It probably would have been that. But you'd never really thought of it as an option. That only sort of grew me as when I realised I wasn't happy doing what I was doing at Rolls-Royce and the other places. Then I kind of began to think about what else I do. So going down to Devon thing was me getting away from all that stuff and trying to just cut that off. And I went to America for the similar reason. I didn't want to go back to that kind of life. So then it kind of gradually, my wife is American. She had an education. She always said, well, if you want to do it, do it. Rather than having to worry about whether you are able to do it, she just said, yeah, go and do it. And that was that. Her confidence in me was allowing me to do it, really.
Yeah, because I guess with obviously, the different time eras, because I, for my podcast, I interviewed Scott Aincliffe, who you may know, but I interviewed him and he's only, I think, early 30s. So obviously, his experience is going to be completely different to yours in terms of the time in which you both got into the industry.
Yeah, I think so. But the thing I've tried when I've seen taught you, lads, the thing I've learned from all that is that you got to believe in yourself. Somewhere inside, you've got to want to do it and make it happen. And I can't teach you that. You've got to find it yourself. But I think doing what you're doing will give you that extra confidence so you can say, well, actually, I can do it. If I want to do it, make it happen. So, you know, there's definitely grades of confidence building and skills building that make it more apparent to you that it's a reality. It can be a reality.
Well, in your time in the industry, obviously a lot has changed, for better or for worse, but how do you feel about how the industry has changed and has evolved? Do you agree with it? Do you feel it used to be better than it is now?
It was more clear where you were in the old days. When I went into newspapers, as I say, they were still making decent money. This would be late 80s, and there wasn't the idea that, like now, that newspapers are a thing of the past. That, you know, that was all really sort of 10 years after we had the internet started up. That's when it really became obvious that newspapers were yesterday's medium, kind of thing. The changes you see, you just got to move with the times. I've said to you, I think I've said before to you, journalism is always at the cutting edge of technology, whether that's printing presses and steam trains taking papers up and down the country, or Twitter or whatever else is next. You know, it's newspapers. Journalism's got to be at the edge of that, because it's got to do things fast, always faster than ever now. What isn't better is the fact that people can put out lies, poorly researched, deliberate lies, or half-baked stories, and they can be passed off as truth. That makes it difficult for everybody, especially people who want to know what's going on in the world. So there's never been more need for journalists than there is now. But finding a job that pays a living wage is becoming more difficult, I'm afraid.
So do you think, with like how modern journalism works, do you think there needs to be more legislations or more checks on making sure that stories are real and not spreading misinformation? I know what.
I don't know how you can do that, though. Who can do that? I mean, if you're a totalitarian government, you might. China does it to some extent. Russia does it to some extent. But we aren't. Half the world isn't. Maybe half. I don't know the numbers. But call ourselves free societies. People are free to talk rubbish.
Yeah. So I guess that comes into like the freedom of speech, doesn't it?
Yeah. But what you need to do is, as I said again, said to you before, and it's a sort of an old-fashioned thing to say now, but trusted brands. Who do you trust? BBC or the bloke down the street who's got a new computer, who's heard of something from his mate at work and is full of conspiracies? They both can get equal prominence in your field of vision. So you've got to decide who you trust. Whoever you work for needs to make sure they're trustworthy to get, you know, to have any real worth, I would say.
Yeah, it's like, anyone can be a journalist these days, pretty much.
Anyone can tell stories, not everyone can be a journalist.
Yeah, exactly. Anyone can behave and
pretend to be a journalist, but then when you look at what the journalism should be, which is what we've tried to teach you, what it should be, you know, the ethics and all that stuff.
Yeah.
We're not talking about transfer rumors, we're talking about people killing each other and why, that kind of stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the important stuff. Yeah. But, you know, it's important to have everything, integrity and everything, whether it's football reporting or Crown Court murder cases. Where do you go for your news, you three?
It depends what I'm looking for. If it's like football news, then I'll check Sky Sports or like
Fabrizio Romano.
No, not Romano. I mean, he's not bad, but I just don't agree with how he gets about, because he basically has a bunch of people that finds people who have already found out the information that he's looking for and then just uploads it and doesn't credit him.
Good stuff. That's good context.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
But no, it'll be like for like Arsenal football news, it'll be like David Ornstein.
It's Carl Anker for United, isn't it?
Yeah. Stuff like that. It's different people for different topics or different areas in life.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. And why do you choose them? Because you can trust them?
Yeah, because their track record's usually pretty solid.
You also have a peek at Football 365 or whatever, all the trashy stuff, just in case it might be true, don't you?
Yeah, of course. You have to. You have to look at the rumors just in case. You got to get yourself excited for something. You got to check the rumors, and then you've got to go back to the reliable sources and wait for them to report it.
These rumors tomorrow's truth.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'll have BBC breaking news notifications on. So if something serious happens, then I'll see that. But mainly, the only news that I tend to look at really is sports. So I'll use Sky Sports News, and I'm a Rotherham fan, so a guy called Paul Davis who works closely with club. Mm. So checking the news like that, it's usually him, because probably the most reliable source that you'll get when it comes to that.
I sat next to Paul Davis at the Star for about 10 years.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, he's a good lad. He's a good reporter, good writer. He's good.
I think for myself, I usually just use the you know, like on like an iPhone or something like that, you've got the drop down and you swipe to your side and you got like the little news section where it gives like the top five stories. You usually like look at that, right. And that can be a mix of like, say, BBC News and Sky Sports and all Sky News. I usually look at that for the headlines then. Typically, I like to go doing like not my own research, but go and look at it myself. Like if it's like a press conference, like for example, all like the stuff going on in America right now with like the elections and Donald Trump. Mm. If I really want to find out about it, I'll find out when like a press conference is and just go watch that myself, and then I can take that information out for myself. Because quite honestly, like let's say American news outlets and stuff like that, if they've got an agenda, they're going to try spin it in whatever they're. Perspective they want to spin it in. So I typically like to go watch the press conferences myself. If not, I try to only really focus on the quotes themselves and not the actual story, because again, depending on what the perspectives are, it can be shifted in whatever way you want it to, and I kind of want it as unbiased as possible. But I think if you had to take like a generalization, realistically you're probably going to go for the BBC's, just because they've got all the accessibility, the reach of what they've got. They're quite reliable. But again, a lot of the time, I think it's very smart to do your own research, because again, if you're wanting, say, news about, say, the Tory party or something like that, but you're going towards a more left-leaning, say, outlet, you're going to have a bit of a clash with biasness, and then you're not going to get a fair outlook on it all for yourself, because then you'll get a different perspective. So
I'm pleased you're all looking at good sources. Did you kind of do that before? Is it something you put away on the course?
I've always done this. because before I came to uni, a few of my mates I went to college with, we ran like a social media page for football news. So a lot of the time we had to go and get quotes and all that jazz ourselves. So we had to go onto Twitter, find out when press conferences are, get all the quotes ourselves, and then do all the stuff like that. So I've been doing it for a good few years now, but it's been mainly down to the fact, like, when I've had conversation with friends and stuff like that, like, say, using Donald Trump for an example, they'll say a quote or something by, let's say, CNN or something, but that's not actually what they've said. And there's this one video that's been quite prominent lately with Donald Trump, where he was in like a lecture hall or something in America where it was really hot and it was sweating buckets, and he made like a statement at the end, basically saying, for all the press and news anchors out there, I'm very well, it's just very hot in this room, just so everyone knows, for a bit of clarity. 10 minutes later, there's all these news outlets and all that, newspapers saying Donald Trump don't look well. Is he fit to run for presidency? So there's a lot of that, I guess, misinformation, because he's clarified it himself. It's just a really hot room. Yeah. But then the press just spin it, and then it turns into one massive thing. So yeah. From that alone, I thought, you know, I don't really trust a lot of it, especially if they've got an agenda against certain someone.
Well, you're right to doubt everything and trust only a few sources. I think that's a good thing to do. And occasionally the BBC will slip up, they'll make a mistake, or a bit of bias will creep into somebody. That's fairly inevitable, that you can't be perfect all the time, or even you can't be very good all the time. Somebody will ask a question, it makes it sound like they're biased towards, or somebody interprets something one way, and you know, that's just the nature of people talking to each other. But I think basically the BBC's hearts and brains in the right place.
I think in terms of, like, say, British news outlets, you can't really fault the BBC that much. Obviously, everyone makes mistakes, and including, like, just organisations as themselves, despite all the risk assessments you do, there's always going to be like a mistake that might slip out, whether it could be anything from like a spelling error or to just missing a key bit of information that could change the story completely. But I think for the grand scheme of things, I think the BBC is, I think, fairly solid.
Yeah, so do I.
Well, you worked at BBC, didn't you, Martin?
I've done stuff for them. I never had a job there. Right. Used to do match reports for them, news stories for them, that kind of thing. Or we would send our stories to the BBC and they would use them. That's more like it.
Yeah, where did you find was the best place for doing football reports and whatnot?
Which ground?
Yeah. Which ground was like a highlight?
Oh, a highlight. Wembley, of course. A few cup final. We used to get cup final press tickets at the start, and to keep your accreditation going, somebody had to go, and I went to 3 or 4 finals, maybe more than that, to report. So we kept getting our tickets for the next year, just in case. When's your United got there? Or Rotherham or Barnsley or Doncaster? All the teams we covered, and Chesterfield. So the best player, I've been to the Anfield, Old Trafford, Chelsea. I went to the Oval. That was an interesting thing. When England were about to win the Ashes, 2005, would it be something like that? The last game was at Lord's, and England needed to win it to win the Ashes. And I said to our editor, if I was a sportsman today, I'd be going down to London to see if I'd get a ticket for the cricket. He says, go on then. So I did. I got on a train, went to the Oval, went in the pub next door, as you do, to see what ticket situation was. No chance of a ticket. I got talking to some bloke, said, well, see that block of flats there? Mrs. So-and-so on the top floor. You take a tenner and a few cans up with you. She'll let you watch it from her balcony. So I did that, and I reported on the game from the balcony, and that was a story about to get in the game without getting in the game, if you like. So that was for a news story rather than a sports story. But it made a great day out for me, and to be able to do that and get paid for it, I always thought was pretty good, that kind of stuff. Just kind of taking a chance and making it work. And as you do it, after you've done that a few times, you're not scared of anything much.
So obviously you lived in America. While you was out there, did you go into any like sport venues or anything like that were like, wow, this is something like that could probably compete with the likes of, like, say, Wembley?
Not straight away, yeah, because of wife's got family, they've been back on holidays. I went to the 49ers stadium, the old one, San Francisco. Went to the Pontiac Silverdome in Detroit, which has been knocked down and rebuilt since then, when Trevor Francis played for them. Remember, you heard of Trevor Francis, former Forest player? Died a year or so ago, won the European Cup with Forest, was a teenage genius for Birmingham City, and then Forest bought him for, I don't know, £1 million, then the first £1 million pound transfer he was. He played then. Where else have I been? The Orioles, Baltimore Orioles baseball stadium, and a couple of smaller ones in San Francisco when I played football out there for an Italian team.
Yeah, because I've seen videos of like the a lot of the college sport grounds. They compete with some of the Premier League stadiums. Like this is one, the AT&T University. I've seen like there the football stadium, it holds like 90,000 people.
Yeah.
So it's like they have money and they've got really impressive stadiums out there. So
one in Michigan, because my wife went to university there, I lived there for a bit. They call it the Big House. Michigan, I think it's University of Michigan when they play Michigan State University, that's a big game. And yeah, they always get 120,000 for that for college football.
Yeah, I've been to Michigan because my uncle lived out there for I think like 25 years, and when I've been out there to visit and everything, been around those events and everything, it's just crazy, like compared to over here when you think there's a lot of people in the grounds and everything, you just wouldn't expect it for some events that they have there.
We lived in Dearborn for a while, where Ford Motor Company started.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then a place called East Lansing, where the university was, Michigan State University.
I thought, you know, I'll just give one last question because I'm intrigued. Have you got any like inspirations? Hope you don't take offense. You sound like John Cooper Clarke. I don't know why in my head. I always think your inspiration is like John Cooper Clarke.
To be honest, you couldn't have said anything better to me than that.
Yeah. It is a compliment, to be fair. He is.
Oh, I know. If you're going to pick a compliment, that was a good one to pick. I do like John Cooper Clarke. I saw him in 1978 for the first time. When he walked on with the pink carry bag stuff up with screwed up poems and picked them out one by one and read them out. Anyway, I like people really of the past. I mean, when I was your age, there was a Daily Mirror columnist called Keith Waterhouse. By him now, it seems old fashioned, and it was old fashioned then. That was the idea of it. I liked him. I used to like when I used to deliver papers when I was 14 or 15. The big journalist who died this year, Australian, doing all the exposés on the Vietnam War. I remember a front page full of skulls that they'd found, mass grave that Americans had killed so many Vietnamese. Oh, Pol Pot, sorry, not the Americans. What was his name? I can't think of his name now. He was a kind of an influence. And then local newspaper writers used to write about local football teams, whether it's Nottingham or Sheffield or Manchester. Got papers from all those places still upstairs and stuffed away with people who I used to like. People like, that's me now, aren't you? David Meek used to cover United for the Manchester Evening News. People like Henry Winter, I really like, who just finished at the Times. Martin Samuel, he's at the Times now. People who are good, who can write seriously, but also who can write tabloidy and in a lively kind of way.
Right. Well, that's brilliant, Martin. I want to say thank you very much. I could talk all day.
Well, I think I have done.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on another exhilarating episode of Inside the Press Box. I've been Jack O'Neill, and I've had the pleasure of guiding you through the exciting world of sports journalism alongside Josh Walters.
And me, your host for this episode, Ollie Gray.
As we say goodbye to another thrilling episode, we invite you to join us again next week, when we will continue to provide you with more insightful information with more exciting guests.
Until then, keep your eyes on the game, ears to the speakers, and remember to stay curious inside the press box.